Your mother said it was entirely up to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course I started to cry. I couldn't tell whether mother wanted me to sell it or not, you know. And I cried, and she come and loved me a little bit and says, "Well, son, I know what it means to you, but you're young. You can easily make another collection." She said, "That's money. That old paper is money. And that's more money maybe than you'll ever see again." Of course, we were poor. I don't believe I'd ever seen a silver dollar up until then. And I hadn't seen a silver dollar then. But I had seen 10-cent pieces. And after I go over my crying, he started to pester me again for a collection. And he says, "Well, I can't raise it any higher because that's all the ready cash. But your mother knows what $1,000 is worth. One, that's 10 of these banknotes. I haven't any more with me because I don't carry lots of money. But I'll make it $1,000 for your entire collection." So I looked up to Mother and she smiled at me. I said, "Take it." Then he turned around to Mother. He says, "Well, Mrs. Hutchings," he says, "that means that I'll have to have you pack these in boxes. And so I'll have to have them shipped to Chicago, to the Field Museum, Chicago." And she says, "Well, I'll do that." And he says, "I'll pay you." And she says, "Oh, no, no. I'll gladly furnish the boxes. My husband's in the store, and I can get all the boxes, dry goods boxes, and then we can have boxes made, you know."
Yes.
We had a sawmill in Lehigh then, so that's my collection, first collection. But it didn't take me long to do more. I had another big collection. By the time I was 18 years old, not only on here, I had expanded to Jordan River. I went along the river and found where their old fisheries had been, where they'd smoked fish. And I picked up hundreds of arrows. And big long spears, this long, you know, they'd spear fish. And I found where they'd had posts up, and then they'd hang the fish over fire to smoke them. Or just cut them open and smoke them. And so that I'd made the biggest part of my collection right there in that little horseshoe bend in the river. Father owned property did it down on the river, and it's just north of that, and I'd run onto that Indian campgrounds. And so it didn't take me long. Well, after the folks died.
Could I ask you one little question?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't help but note you said that $1,000 was so much money, and it was, but you said that you'd never seen a silver dollar and that y'all were poor, yet you had this sawmill and your father had many investments. And how do you explain this?
It was all paper money. Paper money. And his money went right in the bank and in buildings. Sugar factory. All of his surplus, he always kept a year ahead of supplies. always 1 year ahead of everything that we need. And the rest in investments. We never kept money around home.
And as far as money went, y'all were without money.
But that was Mother's, and she, I don't know what she did with some of it, but some of it she, I always had $500 in the bank. They started a bank, and then up here on the state highway, became a hospital afterwards, and she put $500 of that money in the bank for me. And I might as well have spent it, or I might as well she spent it, because my brother Ed, he was older than I, but I always had a job after I got, I was sent to Garland when I was 15 to teach the Navajo, or the Blackfeet Indian kids, to thin beets. They started that big canal in Bear River Canal. You've heard of it?
Yes, sir.
Well, the sugar company went up there and bought 3,000 or 4,000 acres right along that canal. And they put it in sugar beets. Nobody thinned the sugar beets. And so they made a dicker with the Blackfoot Reservation there. And me and five other kids went up there to teach the Blackfeet kids to thin beets. Because I don't remember when I started the thin beets for the sugar company down there. My brother was the chemist. He was the first chemist. And he seen to it that I had got a job. And I was always willing to work and had thin beets, even at 50 cents a day. But when I got up in the Garland, they gave me 50 cents, and they paid my train fare up there, and they paid my board. So I was among the wealthy. And the little girls, little Indian girls, they were just as sweet as children could be. And they'd send enough for their mothers with them to, the mothers would work and they'd go and crawl with the kids until they'd get the knack, you know, and teach them. But they'd always stay there with the children. And they'd, they had 2 hours for dinner, and the mothers go a little ahead and fix them. I don't know what they ate, but they had arranged that I had a horse, and I'd go over to an old man by the name of, what was his name? I can't think, just left me that quick. Wise. John Wise. And I was to go and get my meals at him, so I'd go and never particularly getting there right at time. Kids wasn't either, but I'd get there, and as fast as they'd come, I'd start to work, and they soon, the little girls were very willing to work. I think they was getting 30 cents a day, and that was big money, you know, for Indian. Even the squaws, when they found out at the first payday, what the scads of money their little girls were getting, they wanted work too, and they did. So that problem was solved. Well, they were good to me, and I tried to be good to them. I learned to love the Indians more than I already had love for them. And that's why I believe they selected me to go. They knew that my homestead was always a refuge for the Indians, or my mother's homestead. Summer and winter, fall and spring rather, they'd stop here between. And the marshy part of that was all in cottonwood trees, and going up in the summer, they'd go up to the reservation up here. In the winter, they'd come, and they'd always stop here for a week or two. In there, and my mother, after we got bees, father's second trip after emigrants, he brought bees, and we had scads of honey, and she'd save every old tin can. Put it in there, and then when the Indians come, she'd give them cans of honey. and you should see the things that they would bring for her. Blankets. Blankets of pretty. We had blankets and baskets. Well, everything was in baskets around our house. Those Indians would bring, make presents to Mother, because she'd give them these cans of honey. They'd even give her some of their delicacies to eat. Do you know what they were?
No, sir.
We used to have the Mormon crickets. They were big crickets. They were 2 inches long, the shortest of them, up to 3, 3 and a half. Great big fat crickets. Before my day, was after I was born, but I don't remember Mother and all of them having going out and fighting crickets. But they used to have to go out and fight them, build fires around. And when the crickets would come, they'd see them coming like a cloud, they'd start those fires, and they'd hop into the fires. And then the gulls come, and they ended the cricket problem. But out on the deserts, Indians would get them and dry them. And then sometimes they'd smoke them, and sometimes just dry them. Then they'd pulverize them, and they'd mix that with dried service berries, and sometimes sunflower seeds. Mix it all up together, and that made pudding. And they'd bring Mother a big batch of pudding. Well, not even our pigs would eat it. But we never let the Indians know. She was always very gracious to them. And they thought, oh, they piled baskets and things onto her. Everybody in Lehi had some mother's baskets. They'd pick up potatoes in them and shuck their corn. Everybody had plenty of baskets through Mother's goodness to those Indians, spring and fall.
You mentioned the crickets and the seagulls. Now, is this the same time of the miracle of the seagulls?
Oh, that was before my day. But they didn't all go at once. Every once in a while we'd have a scourge. Even in my memory, it'd come, so we'd have to get out and fight. I didn't, because I was too young. But the older ones would all fight and build up fire with straw, big windrows of straw. And just the Indians, they'd come hopping, you know. And it started going in different places. They'd jump in there and kill a whole swarm of them at once. So they became fertilizer. But the Indians used them to dry. In my diggings, I've found sealed jars with big necks and a clay top on it. Dig that off, and it was full of dried crickets. So the Indians, for centuries, I guess, had feasted on the dried crickets.
You mentioned riding the railroad up to the Indian reservation. Could you tell me what you remember about the first railroad and where the different tracks were laid and where they went?
Well, that's after I started to get mostly the crickets and things. That was afterwards, after the crickets, the road had gone up to Heber from Provo. You see, we were at Provo a good part of the time when the woolen mills were. Provo wasn't very far off, only a day ride in the wagon. So we can go up there, and we'd always go up fishing up the river. And we used to lay in tubs of fish. We all had wooden tubs, and they'd make a good salty brine. Mother, some of the family would go up and get a load of salt, and then we'd have brine to salt our meat down, and also to cook and everything. And we'd salt those things down, you see, with just the salt from Great Salt Lake. And that's what we'd do with the crickets. We'd get them and give them to the Indians. And that's what we'd get fish all along the Provo River. and yet sometimes up into the Uinta Basin, up into the basin. That was the summer trips. So we had our outings.
The whole family would go on these trips?
Yes, mother would go, father would never go.
And the purpose was just to fish?
Oh no, an outing. She never got through her pioneering. She'd driven an ox team
from
Missouri alone. And she took delight in cooking a meal over the sagebrush. And we kids would eat it too.
Could you tell me about your first experience with the railroad and how it affected this community?
Well, the first experience of the railroad in Lehigh, I didn't remember because it came in 1870. I was too young to remember. My brother was the telegraph operator up here, and afterwards, when he wound up his career in telegraphy, he was the chief dispatcher on the Union Pacific from Ogden to Kansas. That's the big railroad center there in Kansas. But he was the dispatcher on the Union Pacific. And before that, he'd been dispatcher from Cheyenne, Wyoming, down here to Utah on the Union Pacific. So, I was pretty well acquainted with the river, with the railroad through him. And you know where he learned telegraphy?
I believe you told me on a tin kettle or something.
Oh, an old iron, cast iron kettle with a loose handle. One end was dot and the other dash. He'd stand up behind that stove hour by the hour and telegraph. And finally, when he applied for a job, he was 17 years old then. They took him to Salt Lake. And he went right off and sent the messages at the same as they did. They sent him right up here to Lehigh Junction. They just established that junction then from there out to Eureka, went out through the Cedar Valley or Rush Valley to Eureka, and up to Silver City in Eureka. But he was set out there as a telegrapher on the Union Pacific. And he was just, he got married when he was 19. He'd been a telegrapher for several years then.
What else did you do as a young man?
Me?
Yes, sir.
Well, I worked for the sugar company a great deal. And after I got big enough and got to the point where I was above thinning beets, I had second hoe for the sugar company, but even then, that's when I started to work at the clay beds. And then from there I went to the mines.
What was your first job at the mine? I know you told
Mucking.
Me, you told me a brief little bit about the boss and how he gave you these books to study.
Yes.
Could you describe what you actually did on your job?
Yes, the first job, I was young then. In fact, it was 1905 when I first went to work underground. I had worked 2 or 3 years on mining before I went underground. But that was just because father had sold most of his big estate and mother was living on money from the bank. And I was too independent. And my older brothers had almost broke her, borrowing money, and never did got a nickel bank. But they'll have that to answer for her too. But I was always on my own. My old brother older than I.
You were a smucker, did you say?
Mucker.
And what did you do? What was a mucker's job?
loading the small cars in the stopes in the mines after they fired the rounds of blasting out the ore, or if it was a tunnel they was driving, they'd put in a row of shots, you see, and that would break about 3 additional feet. They'd try to break 3 feet out of firing. They'd put that, if it was hard, sometimes as much as 16 holes in about 3.5 feet, that would break a 3-foot hole. And those machine men, I got so myself, I didn't expand or contract that 1 inch. My driving tunnel, first contract I had was on a tunnel. It was up in the Alpine Canyon. I had a 500-foot tunnel there to drive through solid rock, and that went just as straight as that wall.
How much were you paid for this job you had?
I got
the job in 1905.
$1.50 and board.
$1.50 a week or $1.50 a day?
A day, mining underground.
Could you describe your boarding and rooming conditions?
Well, it was just the ordinary boarding house that goes with all mines. There's not much to describe. A couple of Chinamen, sometimes 3, and the big ones, there'd be 3, 1 to wait on tables, 2 to cook. One would wait on the tables and try and wash the dishes. But that's all there was to it. You'd go in and wash